United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable William P. Green, Jr., Chief Judge presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good morning. We are convened to hear the case of Sperry versus Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed? All right. With the appellant, counsel state his name for the record. And for the secretary.
The secretary is also ready to proceed, Your Honor, and appearing for the secretary. May it please the court, may it concur to the counsel table today.
Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve any time? 10 minutes for rebuttal. All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, there are two issues in this matter. One deals with the fees for Mr. Leonard, the other deals with the fees for Ms. Teifert. However, there is a preliminary matter that I believe that this court needs to examine before we proceed to the discussion of the attorney fees for either, and that is whether or not the allegation made by the VA in the response to the EJ application is a timely matter to be raised concerning the disqualification of Mr. Leonard. This court's decision in Perry v. West at 11 Vet App 319 established a rule concerning the VA's duty to timely raise an allegation of conflict of interest. The VA's attempt to raise this matter at the EJ proceeding is exactly the same as what occurred in the proceeding in Perry. This court in Perry, in a precedential decision, decided that such a request was untimely and that the facts of that case are nearly identical to the facts of this case involving a counsel who withdrew, and then there was a substitution and the matter was not raised in a motion for disqualification. There is a line of three cases involving a former VA attorney by the name of Kabashnik in the Kelly, Violet, and Perry cases that deal with the question of conflict of interest and how this court was going to approach that question. And in the first two cases, the VA filed a motion for disqualification. In the third case, in Perry, the VA failed to file a motion for disqualification, and Mr. Perry argued that because the secretary had never sought disqualification of Mr. Kabashnik in that case, that the secretary had therefore waived any conflict. This court held that because the secretary had not objected to Mr. Kabashnik's representation, let alone done so timely, that the court declined to address the disqualification issue any further and did
that
not.
That was done in this case, though, wasn't it?
No, it was not.
The secretary didn't raise the question about his qualifications?
Not with this
after
court.
After the briefing was filed?
Not with this court. And part of the cases that are relied upon in Perry, a Seventh Circuit and an Eighth Circuit case, deal with the fact that a motion for disqualification is part of the proceeding and is required to be made, and when it is not timely made, it is waived.
So Perry stands for the proposition that even though you went through the process under 1.9, it was, or... that, in other words, did the government consent or not consent to the individual going forward in the case?
Well, that's not a matter, quite candidly, that's in front of this court. And that's the whole point, is that this court is asked, contrary to the admonition from the Supreme Court, to conduct a second litigation on the question of disqualification after the attorney that is sought to be disqualified has already withdrawn from the case. And this court is now being asked to determine whether there was or there wasn't a conflict of interest for an attorney that's no longer involved in the case. That's precisely what was at issue in Perry and precisely what this court said they were not going to address. And I believe that this panel is bound by that panel decision and should not consider the question of conflict. Now, I am certainly prepared to discuss the issue of conflict with this court and am willing to address it, but I think that this court needs to be aware of its own precedent. Ironically, that precedent was cited by the government in its case, in its pleading, and cited for the portion of the decision which said that how its silence should not be interpreted, but it was after the holding that this court would not address the question of disqualification. And that's essentially what you're being asked to do here in regards to Mr. Leonard. You're being asked in each application to disqualify him in a proceeding in which he is no longer involved, and you are asked to make an after-the-fact determination as to whether there was or there wasn't a conflict of interest.
Why did he withdraw?
He withdrew because he determined that that was in the best interest of his client. There is nothing in his motion that concedes or acknowledges that he had a conflict of interest.
In fact, he acknowledged in the brief that he had, in fact, signed the joint motion for remand.
I'm sorry, he acknowledged in what brief?
Mr. Leonard.
He acknowledged the existence of that pleading, yes. Mm-hmm. But he did not indicate in the pleading because, quite candidly, at that time, he did not recall that his signature was on that particular document. So if the court has no further questions on the timeliness question, in the alternative, I believe that this court should find that there is no conflict of interest, and further that this court should find that this court's decision in Violet is no longer a valid decision that controls the outcome of this case.
Is that because of the rule change, counsel?
That's because of the rule change.
Could you amplify on that for a moment?
That was precisely where I was intending to go, Your Honor.
Well, we're getting clairvoyant, aren't we?
Or I'm getting easier to read. But excuse me, Your Honor. The decision in Violet was entirely predicated upon this court's rule at the time. This court's rule at the time, and what was relied upon in Violet, was the proposition that any attorney who had entered an appearance in a case was necessarily substantially involved in the case, and that constituted a conflict. Judge Steinberg wrote an eloquent dissent, which I think is far more compelling now in light of the change in rule, particularly in light of the facts in this particular case. Because the facts in this case differ from the facts in the Violet case, because the Violet case involved representation in the matter that was before the court at the time. In other words, the case that Mr. Kabashnik had been involved in was the same board decision. In this case, we're talking about an earlier board decision that was vacated upon a joint remand that was prepared by a line attorney and was merely approved by Mr. Leonard.
Yeah, I was curious about that. In other words, Mr. Leonard was the deputy assistant attorney general. General counsel,
yeah.
And was acting in the supervisory role of another mine attorney who was actually involved in the...
Who negotiated the remand, and that the remand was based upon, and I think this is important too, a VCA remand. Because, and the reason that that's important is that what we're talking about is the government's interest. Well, the government's interest in that case was in returning the case back to the board for re-adjudication. The government had no other interest in that case. And to suggest that Mr. Leonard somehow had substantial participation in the case because he simply approved the case is now inconsistent with the current rule. The current rule requires an actual entry of appearance to be filed with this court. Mr. Leonard did not file an entry of appearance with this court in that matter. His entry does not show on the docket sheet. His signature is in the file, but in accordance with the former rule, if he had signed the pleading, that was an entry of appearance. In accordance with the current rule, and the rule that was in effect at the time that Mr. Leonard signed the document. In this case, his signature on that document does not constitute an entry of appearance. Therefore, the vitality of the holding in Violet that 1111 applies does not continue. We don't have those circumstances here, and this court is either going to be required to revisit the question of 1.11 of the model rules to determine whether this panel agrees with the analysis of the former panel in light of the current rule and in light of the application of the facts in this case to those circumstances. And that's where I believe Judge Steinberg's dissent becomes far more powerful, because when we do the analysis as to whether or not there was or was not substantial participation on the part of Mr. Leonard, I do not believe the government's assertion can be sustained.
Let me ask you this, counsel. At the time that Violet was decided, they were looking at Model Rule 1.9A. Am I correct?
1.9 and 111.
And 111.
Yes.
The primary focus was 1.9. And as I recall, in those circumstances, the majority said that they didn't have to look for personal and substantial involvement, that it was more of a per se rule.
That's correct.
For disqualification. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, let me ask you this as a follow-up. When the model rules changed in 2002, did that have any effect on our Violet precedent?
I think it probably did, but I think it ultimately ends up turning on, as I think Your Honor correctly stated it, the underlying premise of Violet, which is there a per se rule? And I do not believe that there is or should be a per se rule. And this case is the evidence for why such a per se rule makes no sense. Because if you simply say that someone that was formally representing the government necessarily has a conflict of interest, is to read out of existence the underpinnings for a conflict of interest. A conflict of interest is that there is some substantial adverse interest that is affected. There is no adverse interest. And in fact, if we are to be candid here, the government's interest is supposed to be in terms of doing justice. And if they are doing justice, then it was not only entirely appropriate for Mr. Leonard to have approved that document, but there was nothing adverse to the interest of the government in his now coming back in a new board decision and undertaking the responsibility for representing the appellant in that case. In other words, there was nothing that he had as a result of his actions in his role as a supervising attorney that constituted a conflict of interest. He brought nothing to the table that gave some unfair advantage to the appellant to the disadvantage of his former client. And clearly, Your Honors, the panel in Violet found that 1.9 should apply equally to the exclusion, in addition to 111, as opposed to the advice that was given in Violet from the expert that said that 1.9 should not apply to government attorneys because 111 controls the disposition of conflict of interest for government attorneys. But at the essence of both roles is whether there is or isn't a substantial interest at stake. And I submit to you that the government cannot present to you any interest that they had that was even remotely endangered by the action of Mr. Leonard in representing Sperry in this case.
Why then, counsel, if you know, did the government not consent in writing under 1.9?
Well, I am privy to that information based upon information that's not in the record, so I'm not quite sure how to respond to that.
You can disregard that.
Okay.
It's not in the record.
However, regardless, that assumes that he needs that permission. And I would suggest to you that he only needs that permission if there is a interest that should have been protected.
Well, I would take it one step further, counsel. It seems to me that the ABA's comments indicate that 1.9 does not apply at all.
You're not going to get an argument from me on that, Your Honor.
I didn't think I would.
And that's why, quite frankly, the what's the right word? The disintegration of the precedential value of Violet based upon the change in this court's rule does allow this court to revisit it. However, quite frankly, you don't need to reach that because this matter shouldn't be here in this context. This court should enforce the rule in Perry, which requires the VA, if they don't want to give their consent, then they're going to have to file a motion to disqualify. Now, that does create some problem when counsel then, as counsel did in this case, turns around and files a motion to withdraw. Does that moot the issue of disqualification? I'm not sure that it does because of the potential for reimbursement under the Equal Access to Justice Act, and therefore the disqualification motion probably should be heard so that this court can make the determination timely, in this case in 2008 as opposed to 2010, as to whether or not there was or was not a conflict of interest. So I'm not really sure that this is the right case for this court to reach that issue. Now, if I could move, unless there's further questions on the conflict of interest question, just briefly to Ms. Pfeiffer's fees. I am not going to discuss the question of the reasonableness of the fees for individual items of work that were performed. I believe that that is a matter that is clearly within the sound discretion of this court, and I will not attempt to suggest to the court what the appropriate determination of reasonableness should be. However, I believe that there is a more fundamental point that needs to be addressed, which is the assertion on the part of the government that Ms. Twyford's fees are necessarily duplicative and repetitive of the work performed by Mr. Leonard. It was, in fact, the government that forced Mr. Leonard out of this case, and therefore any new counsel was going to be required to bring themselves up to speed. And it is simply unreasonable to suggest that an attorney does not have an ethical responsibility to get themselves familiarized with the case. In this case, Ms. Twyford, after reviewing the appellee's brief that came and was filed after her entry of appearance, decided not to file a reply brief. But the fact of the matter was is that she had to read the appellee's brief, make that determination, and make that judgment as to whether or not an reply brief should be filed. And given the ultimate outcome in this case, it's relatively clear that nearly all of the points that were raised by Mr. Leonard in the opening brief were adopted by this court. And I don't believe that this is in conflict with the rule about the discussion of settlement, because it's on the court's docket that the government filed a motion to stay proceedings for a possible joint remand. Now, clearly, if the government wanted to avoid liability for the duplicative work of Ms. Twyford, then clearly all they had to do was to negotiate a joint remand after Mr. Leonard's withdrawal from the case. But they chose not to do that. They chose to allow this case to go to the court for a decision. There was a decision. The board's decision was vacated. And to come to this court now at the aegis stage and to suggest that Ms. Twyford's fees are duplicitous and duplicative of what the work was done by Mr. Leonard simply doesn't stand scrutiny in light of the facts as they exist in this case.
But let me ask you.
Is Mr. Sperry being charged twice for the same work?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, although there is clearly overlapping work done necessarily by one.
Because his cost. I mean, in other words, this whole EJ is for him, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So he's saying to us that he's really being charged twice by lawyers to cover the same work.
Right, but that's no different than any other client who is faced with a former counsel withdrawing and a new counsel entering their appearance. That is part of the cost of doing business in the business place in the
but
legal
in those,
market.
In those circumstances, wouldn't we normally, I guess, if you were to come in on a case after an attorney withdrew, you might want to do a supplemental brief or mm-hmm. something like that. you wouldn't incur the work that the other attorney did.
No, and I'm not sure that it's possible to make that particular division in this case by identifying specific acts. I think it's fair to say that part of Ms. Twyford's time was necessarily involved in reviewing the board decision, but that would have been necessary to review the comments made by the government in the reply brief. Therefore, that work, while the same work that was done previously, is simply another set of eyes looking at the same document, but in the context of what the government's response was to that reply brief. And clearly, once she did that and did the work that she has identified in her application, she concluded that it was not necessary to file a reply brief, which then reduced the cost to Mr. Sperry and reduced the time that this court was going to be required to consider the matter, because they had to consider two briefs instead of three.
Let me just ask you to clarify one point. A few minutes ago you mentioned that that the first counsel had been forced out.
Yes.
And how does that square with your prior statement that the counsel withdrew voluntarily?
I'm on the horns of this dilemma in response to Judge Davis's question about my knowledge that is outside of this record, and I probably should not have phrased it that way. But I think it's fair for the court to read between the lines, particularly given the objection that has been made here now, that Mr. Leonard would not have voluntarily withdrawn had the government decided that they could have waived whatever they perceived to be a conflict. And the fact that the government perceives a conflict does not mean that there was a conflict or that Mr. Leonard felt that there was a conflict. And if he had, quite candidly, he would have put that in his motion to withdraw as the basis for withdrawal.
Counsel,
thank you.
Final question. I know your time's expired. This is real quick. Is there anything in the record other than Mr. Leonard signing the motion in a supervisory capacity that indicates any actual conflict?
Not that I'm aware of, Your
Honor. Okay. Thank you.
Kirshner. May it please the court, Nathan Kirshner for the Secretary once again. Your Honors, fees claimed in this instance by Attorney Leonard are unreasonable because Attorney Leonard had a conflict of interest in this case. It was therefore unreasonable of him to attempt to bill a client for time undertaken.
What was the conflict?
That he signed a dispositive pleading in a previous iteration of this case as a Deputy Assistant General Counsel, Your Honor.
Is that a conflict as defined by Model Rule 1.9A?
I would say that it is, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this then, Mr. Kirshner. The annotations to the 2002 amendments to the model rules have this statement: lawyers formally employed by the government are not subject to the general rule on former client conflicts. For them, Rule 1.11A, B, C, and E supplant Rule 1.9A and B. How do you want us to read that?
Well, Your Honor, given the, as in the pleadings we filed, we relied upon 1.9A per this court's previous holding in Violet and in Perry, that regulation is that model rule is applicable to this court. Given that, Your Honor, that question, going back to Rule 1.11, that nevertheless prohibits conflicts of interest or cases where there is a conflict or states there is a conflict of interest, where the previous attorney had participated personally and substantially in the previous litigation.
And how did the attorney in this case participate personally and substantially?
Your Honor, he was the Deputy Assistant General Counsel. He drove the metaphorical bus. As a line attorney, I'm responsible for research, drafting of pleadings, proposing a JMR to my supervisor, my Deputy Assistant General Counsel. However, it's not until that the Deputy Assistant General Counsel gives me approval to file the pleading that I am able to do so. So, in other words, in this case, what happened due to office procedure is that the line attorney likely drafted the joint motion for remand, gave it to Attorney Leonard for review. Attorney Leonard familiarized himself with the case enough to approve the joint motion and signed on to it. That, Your Honor, is personal and substantial.
And so is it your position then that you can personally and substantially participate without making an appearance?
It would be an
appearance. Or do you assert that he made an appearance?
We assert, once again, going back to Violet, Your Honor, that he made an appearance. I recognize that there may be some issue with the change in the court's rules, but I was not aware of that and did not brief it. However,
he made an appearance by signing the motion.
Is that your position? In supervisory capacity, and again, per Violet, Your Honor.
The answer is yes?
I believe so, Your Honor, again, per Violet.
Okay.
And you're familiar with the current rule with regard to making an appearance? Basically, let me just inform you, if I may. Appearance, this is from the same section that was the prior rule, Rule 46. No practitioner may appear on behalf of a party or amicus in any proceeding in a case without first filing a written notice of appearance in the detail prescribed by Form 3 in the appendix of forms, and a copy of any fee agreement, which isn't applicable here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's where these questions then focus, is on our change in our rules with regard to what constitutes an appearance, and the reliance on appearance as representation in Violet. So I'd like for you to address that, if you would, please.
Sure, absolutely, Your Honor. The interesting thing to note is that an appearance is not required to participate personally and substantially in a matter under 1.11. Regardless of whether an appearance was filed, I think the facts of this case show that Attorney Leonard did participate personally and substantially in the previous matter in signing the JMR and approving it, and essentially binding the agency to a course of action at that stage of the litigation, because that is the role of the Deputy Assistant General Counsel. They are the ones who make the call on what course of action binds the agency.
And what is the material adversity?
Material adversity, once again, it's the this was essentially the same case, the same matter, and not only that, part of the current board's decision, which was remanded by this court, deals with an effective date for a rating for a period of PTSD, which was precisely the same date range for which I believe, or includes the date range for which the initial JMR was signed.
But compliance with the VCAA was not a subsequent issue.
No, but nonetheless, it's all part and parcel of the claims process for disability benefits, Your Honor, and we would assert that it is the same matter. Given that Attorney Leonard had a conflict of interest, as I previously stated, it is...
Well, if it wasn't substantial material adversity, a lawyer wouldn't necessarily be conflicted.
Potentially not, Your Honor. However, the model rules, and again, I'll go back to 1.9 because that was what we were relying upon in our pleading. This kind of a conflict of interest can only be waived via a direct signature. So I would say, given our assertion and argument that it is the same matter, since there was no waiver of conflict in this case, the conflict stands regardless.
How do you deal with the... Mr. Carpenter's assertion that this court should never reach any of these questions because the VA didn't appropriately raise this issue to the court in appropriate pleadings asking for disqualification?
I would respond to that in two ways, Your Honor. First of all, the idea of a preliminary issue, I believe, I'm not certain that that was raised in appellant's response to our response to his application. So I'm not sure it's the appropriate forum to raise that initially. In terms of the interpretation of Perry, what Perry essentially said was that counsel for the secretary has to object in a timely manner upon discovery of the conflict, and that is precisely What I did in this case, as soon as I discovered the conflict, I contacted Attorney Leonard, informed him of the situation, and, which is on the court's docket, we entered into a joint stay to attempt to resolve the conflict of interest situation. After that, Attorney Leonard withdrew. So because, Your Honors, Attorney Leonard had a conflict of interest, it was unreasonable for him to bill his client for that time, as was laid out in our initial response. Numerous courts have found that such billing is inappropriate, and we ask that the court also finds in this instance.
Let's assume that the court gets to this issue of what the rules require. Should this panel apply to this case the current model rules, or should we rather be bound by whatever Violet said about rules that have since changed?
I would say, Your Honor, that likely the court should be bound by Violet insofar as that it is bound by its precedent, and yet at the same time by the current rule insofar as it is bound to enforce the rules by its own rules. The court's rules, I believe they are 4A and B, and 4061 provide that the model rules are binding upon this court. So in either event, Your Honor, I believe the model rules are for application, and in either event, Your Honor, as I there was a conflict of interest in this case.
But if we were to apply the current rules, based on the comment that I read to you and other comments that are included in the discourse on the change in the rules in 2002, it appears to me that Rule 1.9A simply would not apply. Now, I think you've answered the rest of that with regard to your argument with regard to substantial involvement, but would you concur that Rule 1.9A would not currently be applicable to a prior government attorney?
And frankly,
and I don't want to be unfair to you.
Frankly, Your Honor, I'm not certain, to be quite honest, because again, we were basing our a position on the court's holding in Violet regarding 1.9A. However, if the court were to find 1.11 instead were applicable, there's nonetheless a conflict of interest.
Because, in your view, the attorney participated personally and substantially. Is that correct?
Yes.
By reviewing line attorney's work?
Not only reviewing the work, Your Honor, in essence directing the course of action. The line attorney merely recommends a course of action, but for example, if I were to recommend to Deputy Quinn that we file a joint motion in a case and he does not agree with that, he could tell me, you know, I looked at the case, I don't agree with it, go write the brief instead.
Isn't it a fair statement that literally thousands of JMRs for VCA compliance were being approved at the time that this one was?
I'm not aware, Your Honor. I perhaps I was not a member of the bar at that point.
Well, we were, and I can testify to that.
You can also look at the court's annual report posted on the court's website. You can also look at the Chairman of the Board of Veterans Appeals annual reports with regard to workload during that period.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, given that, as we've asserted, there is a conflict of interest and it would be unreasonable to bill a client for these fees, it's unreasonable for Attorney Leonard now to attempt to bill the government for these fees. That, Your Honors, goes all the way back, I believe, to Hensley, if I'm not correct, or if I'm correct. Moving along, if there are no further questions regarding the reasonableness of Attorney Leonard's time, we will turn to Attorney Twyford's time. As we argued in our pleading, the government believes that Attorney Twyford's attempt to seek fees in this case is unreasonable because she didn't provide a distinct contribution. If we go back to Baldridge, Your Honors, Baldridge directs that it is appropriate to bill for the time actually needed to achieve a favorable result. And here, because the only thing...
would you not examine the work of a previous attorney if you came in on the case subsequent to that attorney withdrawing?
I would, Your Honor.
And you would, what, do it for free?
Perhaps, Your Honor. The representation agreement, as Attorney Twyford notes, she is appearing without charge in this case. However, yes, I do think it would be, of course, wise to review the previous
pleadings. If you didn't, you really have a problem, wouldn't you?
Of course, Your Honor.
Particularly where there's a potential cloud on the horizon with regard to conflict of interest with the prior attorney.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that maybe in those circumstances, if you were the second attorney, you might even look a little bit harder.
I believe I would, Your Honor. Assuming, without conceding, that some fee is reasonable for Attorney Twyford, the fees charged nonetheless appear to be largely unreasonable, non-productive, and duplicative. For instance, we have here a case where, for example, on May 1st, there was 1.5 hours billed to review Mr. Leonard's brief. However, the brief was 17 pages long, and that results in over 5 minutes per page. Similarly, to review the secretary's brief, Attorney Twyford spent, 2.3 hours to review 8 pages. That's 17 minutes per page. To review this court's decision, she spent 2 hours for a 10-page decision, or 12 minutes per page. Fees such as this, Your Honor, of course, within the court's discretion, and again, in the alternative, should be held to be unreasonable, along with those we specifically referenced in our pleading as duplicative.
When you're reading pleadings and case decisions, though, isn't it reasonable to anticipate that a person might not know every case that's cited and might actually want to check the citations and even read the cases?
It is, Your Honor.
I'd assume that's why it takes longer to read our decisions, although you might postulate that there are other reasons. But I would hope that that's the reason.
Yes, Your Honor. And, of course, again, regarding our alternative argument, it's within the court's discretion. We are simply raising these issues. If there are no further questions, the Secretary once again asks that you deny the fee claimed for work done by Attorney Leonard in full, as should you for the fee of Attorney Twyford, as it was not productive, and in the alternative, reduce the fee to one the court deems reasonable. Thank you.
Let me just add one thing, Counsel, since I've given you a couple of citations, the things that I think perhaps VA should take a look at. I think you also ought to take a look at the ABA Formal Ethics Opinion 97-409 concerning the overlap between Rule 1.9 and Rule 1.11. That was a 1997 opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, it seems to me that this matter has been resolved in relationship to 1.9, that the change in this Court's rule, the change in the interpretation, or at least the clarification of the interpretation, not to mention the fact that apparently there is an opinion from 1997 that discusses in the opposite view that was taken by the panel in Violet. Violet just simply doesn't control the outcome of this case any longer. What controls the outcome of this case, should you get to the question of conflict, is 1.11. under 1.11, it simply does not follow, consistent with this court's decision in Kelly. Omitted from the government's the government's objection in its reliance on Violet and Kelly was the first case of the three cases involving Mr. Kabashnik in the Kelly case. And in the Kelly case, Mr. Kabashnik was involved with the same appellant that he signed a pleading on, transmitting the board decision, left the office of the general counsel, and then undertook the representation through the consortium on a pro bono basis for that same appellant. The court found in Kelly that such an action of simply signing a document for the transmittal of the board decision was a ministerial act.
But in Kelly, isn't it true that the counsel had no review authority over the work product?
I'm not sure that that's correct, Your Honor, because as I understand it, he would have been the line attorney at that time, and had he stayed with the general counsel's office, that he would have in fact done that. Now, having left the general counsel's office, he was obviously no longer in that position. But I'm not sure that that's a fair, and obviously I was not involved in that case, but as I read the facts of the case, he was the attorney assigned and required to, move that case along once the notice of appeal had been filed. Now, whether he was then later, he was obviously then later replaced as the attorney handling that case, and in fact then undertook representation of the appellant. But I guess my point is, Your Honor, that this court recognized in Kelly that there are certain functions that members of the Office of the General Counsel undertake that are ministerial in nature. And yes, I suppose it is a fair statement that every supervising attorney ought to be reviewing the work product in a joint remand. But this was a joint remand on a VCAA remand. I mean, there wasn't anything of any substance to be reviewed, and most importantly, there was no material interest of the government other than, at that time, to return the matter to the board. Now, the fact is that the government stands up here and repeatedly asserts that Mr. Leonard has a conflict. But when pressed by this panel as to precisely what he did, all he did was to sign as approving the joint motion for remand, and assert that that is personal and substantial participation in that litigation is simply unreasonable in light of what the expectation is of Rule 1111.
But Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Kirchner actually addressed that question directly, didn't he, and indicated that based upon how the Deputy General Counsel functions that he had a little bit more than signature authority.
And
that I think his language was he drives the bus.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't mean to disparage the bus of the VA General Counsel's office, but in the context of a VCA remand, a licensed driver was not required. There just wasn't anything of substance, Your Honor. And that's what drives Rule 1.11. Now, if it was a matter of substance, if it was a dispute about the same matters that were resolved by Your Honor's decision in the subsequent appeal, that's a different kettle of fish. That's a different set of facts. Those are not the facts in this case. And to suggest that the government at this stage, at the aegis stage, can waive filing a motion to disqualify, waive establishing that there was in fact a conflict of interest in 2008 when they say they became aware of it, when Mr. Leonard was still part of this court before this court allowed him to withdraw. That's what this court's decision in Perry requires. That wasn't done here. And to suggest that somehow Mr. Sperry is prevented from raising that at this time is simply inconsistent with the case law. The case law requires them to timely plead it. They didn't timely plead it. They waited 2 years and pled it in the context of Egypt. That's too late, and it's analogous, quite frankly, to the specific pleading requirement established in in Q cases in the Andrews case, in which they say if you don't make the specific allegation, you can't make that allegation for the first time at court. And they're making that allegation for the first time to this court in the context of Egypt. That is not merely an allegation. That is a motion to disqualify counsel, which requires fact-finding, which requires a record, and this court doesn't have that record. This court is asked to intuit the result, and that is not an appropriate request for this court's exercise of jurisdiction. Unless there's any further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. The case is submitted. We will greet counsel, and the case, or the court will adjourn.
All rise.